I'm supposed to die in the year 2047 on October 23rd, based on probabilities.
Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Jabber podcast. This episode is brought to you and supported by the WitchMat app, the app that helps Jiu-Jitsu athletes find their mat. Visit witchmat.com for details. If you have any ideas or any suggestions as to how we can continue to grow our little podcast, you can ping me on Instagram at my WitchMat profile. On today's show, we have a guest that believes the next big threat to our nation, and indeed the world, will not come in the form of a nuclear strike, but rather from a digital angle in the form of cyber terrorism. Today, we have information systems security professor and author, Dr. Randall Boyle. Dr. Boyle is a tenured professor of management information systems and Willard Eccles Fellow at the Business and Economics School in Weber State University in Utah. He received his PhD in management information systems from Florida State University in 2003. Dr. Boyle's research areas include deception detection in computer-mediated environments, data breaches, secure information systems, the effects of IT on cognitive biases, and on knowledge workers. He has authored several academic journals and books on the topics of information systems and cybersecurity. As always, the theme of our podcast is jiu-jitsu, and Dr. Boyle has also spent a significant amount of time on the mat as well. Dr. Boyle, welcome.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here with you today, and thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Absolutely. Now, Randy, you were also just recently a Fulbright scholar at the University of Warsaw, Poland. In your return time and indeed your information securities expertise couldn't be better timed.
Yeah, that's correct. I was there. I started in the fall and then I was at the University of Warsaw until about I was about a week and a half to 2 weeks into the invasion. Russia invaded Ukraine while I was at the University of Warsaw. It was a very tense time. The whole mood of the city and the perceptions of the people had changed. But even 2 weeks before the invasion, people had started coming from Ukraine into Warsaw. So a lot of expats that live in Ukraine, like all the other Fulbright fellows from Ukraine, had started coming in. All these NGOs started to leave Ukraine and come to Warsaw. So Warsaw started filling up with a lot of people even 2 weeks prior to the invasion.
So can we just kind of jump right in? The hacktivist group Anonymous announced relatively recently that they were about to engage in cyber warfare with Russia, you know, over this situation in the Ukraine. Are NATO countries at the outset of a cyber war with Russia, in your opinion?
Not a major one. Russia and hackers are hitting the United States government, the Department of Defense specifically, and U.S. companies every single day. None of it makes headlines because there's no blood on the pages. Right. There's an old saying that says if it bleeds, it leads, and cybercrime includes very little blood. But there's DOS attacks, data breaches that occur every single day. Hundreds of millions and billions of records are lost on a continuous basis. So if anything, the war has been ongoing since about 2008. That's when we saw a huge uptick in cyber penetrations. And this was mainly due to the shift to the cloud. Companies moved all their data and resources to the cloud, and that, shocker, made them accessible to people. Yeah. Russia is 130 milliseconds away from my computer right now. It's 130 milliseconds away, and I don't need a passport. And neither do the Russian hackers, and they know this. But when I was in Warsaw, you did see a major ramp up in cyber war just before the invasion. So Ukrainian and Polish systems and the UK and German, they all got hit substantially more than the daily attacks that occur. So yes, there's a saying is that the cyber attacks occur just before the kinetic or the hot attacks. So before the bullets and the bombs come, the cyber attack comes. And we did see this time also. Cyber attacks have always and will always occur just before the kinetic bullets and bombs start falling.
What's your perspective on groups like Anonymous? Some people kind of see them as modern day digital Robin Hood in a way. Do you perceive them as goodies or baddies?
They are not modern day Robin Hoods. They are modern day mercenaries. if you look at their past attacks, they do what is, so this attack on Russia is just a virtual signaling thing. It's a PR campaign to try to make themselves look better, but they've done lots of horrible things in the past. They're not Robin Hoods. I mean, they're not doing exclusively virtuous things to exclusively bad people. They are purely opportunistic. Just because they're helping attack the Russians today doesn't mean they're going to turn around and stab you right in the back. So they're essentially digital mercenaries that are out looking out for number one.
So they're not necessarily super well respected by the securities community.
They're highly skilled, no doubt. But morally, no. They are morally ambiguous, which even if you asked them, they'd say, yeah, we're morally ambiguous.
How much truth is there behind this concept of the idea that Google or Facebook are a dangerous collection of private companies there to sort of brainwash us? And, you know, should we all delete our Gmail accounts ASAP?
Yes, they do try to persuade public opinion. Facebook does this more than Google. Google, I've been surprised. They have actually tried to be more transparent, which I didn't think they would do. But you have to consider, when I look at companies and you try to talk about motives and everything, the most important thing you can do is look at the money. Where do they make their money? If you look at Google and Apple, they're about the same value. One goes up, one goes down, they're about the same. Apple sells hardware, right? I mean, they sell iPhones and tablets. But what does Google sell? Where do they make their money? 98% of Google's money is made on advertising. It's not hardware. My whole house is full of Google hardware, but I am an exception. You know, I pay for Google storage and everything, but most people don't. 98% of it comes off ad. And what is ad essentially? It's the selling of people's privacy. When you say, oh, these companies are privacy violators, look at the money. They'll tell you. They are renting people's eyeballs. They're selling information about people to make money. And that's 98% of their income. Apple is not, because the bulk of their money comes from hardware sales. But Facebook, absolutely. Absolutely, they're selling your privacy. Should I get rid of my Gmail account? Not really. It's free in terms of monetary. But remember, if you're not paying for it, you are the product. And that's an old saying that rings true. And you say, well, how much? Well, take Apple and Google, and they're about the same value, and say, how much did I pay for my iPhone? And that's how much your privacy is worth, net-net. Because Google makes money off of selling people's privacy, and Apple makes money off selling people's hardware. And net-net, people say, yeah, but how much is my privacy worth? It's worth about an iPhone. But not everybody's is the same. You take a poor degenerate like yourself, Dave, and your privacy is worth almost nothing. you take a rich, wealthy information magnate like myself, and my privacy is worth like a Ferrari. So if you're a poor person, you shouldn't be screaming, oh, they're going to get my privacy. Your privacy is not worth that much. But if you have cash money in the bank, if you have a reputation, if you have all this, you should consider getting off of social media. You should protect yourself more if you have things to protect.
I think that's the crux of it, isn't it? That, you know, I have a Gmail account, I have a Facebook, but I don't post, you know, sensitive information in there. And really, to that matter, if you have very sensitive information on your laptop or on your device, you should not only be concerned with which of these large major industries or major groups that you're working, that you're sort of using their products, but also be concerned with the very fact that your device is connected to the internet at all. So it's kind of like, look, use Gmail for what you can use it for and the value that you find in it, but just be aware of the dangers of being connected to the internet, period, no matter what company you're using.
There's an old saying, it's called TANSTAFL. It's an acronym that says there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. That's what TANSTAFL stands for. And when everyone says, oh, it's free, you just say in your mind, TANSTAFL, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And Google gives you a free Gmail account, and I assure you, it is not free. They will get their blood. They will get their blood for sure. But if you're worried about privacy, there's lots of great European private secure email. And If I had my dream, I would store all my data in Germany, where you've got great data privacy. The Europeans are miles ahead of the Americans in data privacy, but the Americans produce great apps, and this is where a lot of the innovation is occurring. So when you live in the world, it's difficult because, you know, I'm not familiar with it. Most of the general population isn't familiar with all these European data storage providers email providers. So it can be a little problematic, but I envy my German counterparts and European that have these great data privacy. But we have great apps and great services, and it's awesome in America, but I envy their data privacy.
Now, you and others like you have said the real threat of World War III may not necessarily be the physical soldiers on the ground, but something potentially a lot worse, which would be cyber war.
It could be, yes.
Mm-hmm. So as an example, I suppose we just recently had an incident of a successful sandworm attack from the Russian GRU. And then there was one previously, I believe, in 2018. Can you explain what that is?
In general, not every government has cyber divisions. US does, Russia does, China does, Israel, France, the UK. Major developed countries have major cyber divisions. And they sometimes have military targets, sometimes they have civilian targets. And in general, the United States tracks a lot of these divisions. We call them APTs, or Advanced Persistent Threats. Sometimes they're hacker groups, and sometimes they're outright military divisions. And the line is intentionally blurred between military and private contractors. It's intentional. What they really are interested in, we saw it in Ukraine. First, you always attack communication systems, and then you start to go for infrastructure, power, water, all these type of infrastructure systems. These systems are controlled by what are called SCADA systems. And over the past 20 years, the U.S. has made a substantial effort to secure these SCADA systems from cyber attack. They did assessments in the year 2000, especially going up to the date change, which was a big nothing burger. But they assessed these systems based on cyber attacks. The internet got born about 1995. 5 years later, people are like, could someone do this remotely? And yes, they could. 2008 rolls around, everybody starts moving towards the cloud. And then we start seeing these huge hacking attempts. So they've really tried to protect these infrastructure. But what they haven't protected are companies, your data. So these are very, very vulnerable to attack. And we saw this in Ukraine. And also, each country is not as susceptible as other countries. Take North Korea, for example. They are not highly dependent on information technology, just because they're not developed. But if you take the United States, we're very dependent on information technology. We use it for our payment systems, our Coke machines. We use it for our, if you look in my house, I mean, everything's digital. My thermostats, smoke detectors, kids' toys, everything connects to the internet. So if a large EMP weapon or a large cyber attack occurred, my house would be damaged. The same thing is true of companies. So as you become more dependent upon information technology, the impact of a cyber war will affect you more. And also, you have to look at which countries have the capability to affect a cyber war. So some countries can really attack effectively, others cannot, but some are more vulnerable than others.
It's interesting and kind of reassuring that a securities expert such as yourself has such a digitally connected household with your family there. You clearly feel comfortable enough in light of everything that we've talked about to have such a system in place.
Yeah, I keep all the analog stuff in boxes in my garage. I like cutting edge technology, but I'm sure not going to throw all my analog stuff away. I keep it all. But you also have to have judicious use of technology. I have monitoring cameras, but I don't put them inside my house because they have microphones on them. And that's just not a smart thing to do. I don't put any microphones in my bedroom or areas where privacy might be violated, but I like my smart TV. So you have to, just because it is available doesn't mean you should use it.
Is Amazon listening to me right now with Alexa on my table?
Yes.
She literally just said, sorry, I don't have an answer. Now, the Alexa is actually not on my table, but it's in the room next to me. And she just responded. So Is there some concern there? I know people that won't keep Alexa or Google's device in their house because they feel this fear of Google or Amazon always listening.
So yes, they are listening. What you have to be concerned about is, are you doing anything? So I would say this, don't write anything in an email that you wouldn't want published on the front page of your local newspaper. And it's the same thing in your house. If you're living a normal life, a very mundane life, like I do in my house, what do I care? Knock yourself out. Try, go ahead, publish it in the newspaper. You'll get zero readership because no one's interested in my mundane. But if I were operating an illegal enterprise, like growing weed or drugs or selling illegal, you know, stolen car parts, I definitely would not have Amazon in or Alexa in my house. If I was developing intellectual property, if I was working for the Department of Defense, if I was working in an R&D institute, developing drugs or anything, absolutely not. You cannot have any of these devices in your home. You know, if you're a doctor and you're just discussing patient things, you cannot have one of these devices. So it depends on who you are. But for most people, it doesn't matter. For some people, like people I personally know who have TS clearances that work on very sensitive systems, absolutely not. They cannot have them in their homes, no.
In my head, I think of movies, you know, where the entire electrical grid is turned off instantly, the lights go out, and we're sort of all doomed from some awful cyber attack. How real is that kind of a scenario? Is it really such an instance where it can be lights out, the electrical grids can go down, medical care can cease to function correctly?
If there was a cyber attack 20 years ago, yes. Today, it is highly unlikely. So mostly due to U.S. federal, in the United States, I'm speaking. In the United States, the federal U.S. government spent a lot of money to secure a lot of these SCADA systems, water and power specifically. The big threat to that doomsday scenario isn't a cyber attack. As a cyber attack will take down companies, it'll have communication issues, but it won't take out your power and water. Typically, we worry about nuclear reactor meltdowns, but the big threat comes from an EMP blast or an electromagnetic pulse. So the ones they really worry about are a high altitude nuclear detonation, and it causes an EMP blast that'll melt all your chips and turn back the dial to the United States back to the early 1900s. And for people who are highly dependent upon technology, this could cause mass starvation. Your cars don't work, your refrigerator stopped working. So it's the real worry is a large EMP weapon. A cyber attack will really inconvenience you. You'll lose your data, you'll be pissed off, but you won't die. But from a large EMP, it would be very, very bad.
Now, for people listening, there are some interesting books out there. The Cuckoo's Egg is an interesting book.
There's a book by Richard Clark called Cyber War. It's a great book. If you're interested in cyber war, get Richard Clark's book and read it. He goes extensively in what a cyber war would look like, the steps leading up to it. Most cyber people know what's going to happen as we get closer to a cyber war. But we're not there right now. We were there when Russia invaded. We saw these massive attacks on most of the NATO allies. The stupid thing with that is you show your cards. That's what's so dumb. You start attacking Poland. They're like, okay, this is exactly what they're going to do if the next time they come around. And then it allows Poland, the UK, Germany to start taking steps to prepare against it. So it's like watching the fight tapes so that you can plan for the next match, you know? Kind of a bonehead move to launch all your cyber attacks on Ukraine, and then you just telegraphed what you're going to do to the rest of the world if a cyber war actually broke out.
So in your opinion, where does this Ukraine-Russia conflict end?
What Russia really wants, they want a land bridge from Russia to Crimea. And you can see it in their attacks. They have just flattened Mariupol, which sits between Donbass and the Crimea. So what they want to do is get this strip of land that goes from Russia through Donbass, through Mariupol into Crimea. So my prediction, if I had to put a line on it and put it in Vegas, May 9th. I think he'll end the war on May 9th, which is a very historic day when the Russians declared victory over the Nazis. And that was one of his stated goals. We're going to destroy the Nazis, you know? And I think May 9th, he'll declare a victory because it's costing him, you know, $50 billion a day. And it's very expensive. His troops are performing very badly. So on May 9th, he'll come up and say, he'll say, we won. So he's pulling his troops out of the north. He's moving them down south. He's putting them, he's going to try to solidify Donbass, Mariupol, and Crimea. And he'll take that lower section, which will give him Landbridge and all these warm water ports. And then he'll declare victory and it'll be over. And then he hopes the German demand for oil and, you know, Germany, Italy, and Turkey will force his hand, and they'll, all the sanctions will come off, sanctions will slowly come off over the next year. And then, because he really cares about public internal opinion of himself. He doesn't care what the West thinks. United States, he needs the West to be an enemy. So I would look for 1 month from now for the conflict to be over. I would put it at 60%. There's a 40% they could drag it out another 2 years, but I doubt that. Internally in Russia, it looks bad, and no one's going to say anything, but I predict one more month, May 9th.
And you just came back from Poland. Your family are back and everybody's safe, thankfully. As an aside, you're fluent in Polish and Russian, correct?
Yep.
So how did you manage that?
I did a service mission for the LDS Church, and I lived in Poland for 2 years. Polish and Russian share a lot of the same root words. It's about 70% were called cognates or very similar root words. I got a bunch of almost straight A credit in my Russian classes because I already spoke 70% of the class. All I had to do was learn the Cyrillic alphabet and a handful of words. Man, I was doing great in my Russian classes, but then my mind kept getting so confused. I had to quit studying Russian and just focus on Polish because I kept mixing up my languages.
Say something in Polish and then say the same thing in Russian.
So take an easy word like mucha, which is fly. It's the exact same word in Russian and Polish. Mucha, mucha. It's fly, like a fly that flies around the room. It's the exact same. If you say goodbye, you know, do svidania, everybody knows that. But in Polish, it's do widzenia, you know, see ya. So it sounds similar. So when I listen to Russians, if I listen really hard, I mean, I can kind of piece it together. Czechs are much more understandable to me, but they sound kind of funny. It's kind of like listening to Ewoks. That's what Czechs are. You're like, baga, baga, baga. And you're like, what? Why are you saying that funny accent, man?
But that's incredibly inappropriate.
Yes. Sorry.
Tell us about, I suppose we have to talk about jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience with Polish BJJ. What was that like?
It was actually great. I trained at Club Copacabana in Warsaw, and I'd only ever studied at Carlson Gracie here in Salt Lake. And I didn't know how good my training was. You know, if you only study at one place, you only know how good you are. And I was nervous. I was like, I'm going to go there and they're going to smash me. I'm going to get choked. And I went there and I did really well, really, really well, with an asterisk, because I was an American. And they were taking it easy on me, quite frankly. And some of them, because you'd get on top and they just hold there. I was like, why aren't you fighting back? And they're like, I don't know. Because Poles really love Americans. They do polls of, you know, they ask a question, do you love Americans? And you know which country is at the top of the list? Poland. Poles love Americans. Every American is a minor celebrity when you go to Poland, and they just warmly greeted me. But I'd get in there and I did really well in all the sparring sessions. But part of me was sitting there going, did I do well because of my training, or did you let me kind of win because I'm an American? And add on top of that, I was a professor at the University of Warsaw, which adds another layer, because especially in Polish culture, that the professors are an intellectual level and greatly respected, but not with the black belts and the brown belts. They would throw down on me, and they were incredibly great fighters. But I'm very grateful to Carlson Gracie because they teach great fundamentals. It was really, really great. The Polish system, at least in the club I was at, it was much more playful. Whereas at, like at Carlson Gracie, it's a lot of sparring, very fundamentals, aggressive, you know, prep you for tournaments and that, where there it was much more playful in nature. So the first 5-10 minutes, you'd stretch your neck out and stretch your arms, and then you'd play games, like slap the guy on the shoulder, and you play all these fun games. So it was very entertaining, and you got to know people really well. And like the kids, all four of my kids would go to jiu-jitsu, and also while we were there. And you can't even choke someone in Poland until you're 12 years old. And my kids didn't know this. My kids get in there, and they're choking everybody, and the teachers are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What are you Americans doing? I says, we play for blood. She's like, I says, choke them. And they're like, no, you can't choke them. I was like, oh. And I tell my kids, I says, don't choke any of these kids. They're like, well, how do we win, Dad? I says, I don't know. Call them harsh names. I don't know. And she goes, no, it's if you get on top, you're winning. So we had to learn a little. There were some little subtle differences, but the kids really enjoyed going and playing a lot of these games. So it was really a lot of fun.
Now you unfortunately you kind of popped your ankle twice.
Is that what happened? I loved sparring. Unfortunately, I put my foot up at the wrong time for a tripod sweep, and someone popped my ankle, and so I was walking wounded for a couple weeks. Yeah.
So just for anybody interested, is Poland a safe place to travel to? Is now okay, Ukraine in general, in sort of before the war, after, et cetera?
Yes, it's very safe. In fact, if I had to choose to travel or live in a city, like if you gave me San Francisco versus Warsaw, I'd choose Warsaw hands down. I mean, it is much, much, much safer than any major American city. I had some colleagues visit, some other professors visit from other universities. And I said, we were walking down Old Town. I says, what don't you see? And they look at me and they're like, there's no homeless people. There's no drug addicts. I was like, yep, none. Absolutely none. There's no homeless people. There's no drug addicts. And they're like, and there's no fat people either. I was like, ouch. I was like, yeah, that's true. There's no fat people. But Poland is a very safe, modern city. They have huge skyscrapers, but it's actually much safer than any large American city. And it's, you know, there's a police presence that keeps people moving along. There's no encampments. Like I went to San Francisco. I was attacked twice in 3 days, just accosted by people on the street. And there's needles. And I literally stepped in human feces when I was in San Francisco. But to go to Warsaw, awesome. And you're treated like a celebrity. I mean, my wife, she was deathly afraid. She goes, are people there going to speak English? Man, everybody speaks English. In fact, they want to speak English with you almost all the time. So in general, the majority of the population speaks English because it's a universal language.
Now, clearly, there are some really great career opportunities in your field. For someone listening to the podcast that might have an interest in getting involved in information systems security in MIS, can they reach out to you directly? What's the best way to get involved?
Yeah, they can reach out to me directly. My email address is randyboyle@weber.edu, and you can just email me. And we offer undergraduates MIS with an emphasis in cybersecurity. We have graduate certificates. We're like mini master's degrees, or like 15, a small number of credit hours. And you can get a full-blown master's degree in cybersecurity. The job market is extremely hot right now. I mean, it's hot, hot, hot. I look on LinkedIn, and I mean, there's 10 job postings a day. And these aren't burger jobs. I mean, these are $100K a year jobs if you have a master's degree. I mean, they're really, really great jobs. Put 3 years worth of work into it, you make $100,000 for the rest of your life, and you're not out shoveling snow. I did a presentation the other day to the National Board of Directors at Weber State. I went and presented to them, and they said, they wanted me to talk about the impact of war in Ukraine and COVID on the future. And I said, the war in Ukraine is going to bring a large amount of defense spending to Utah. Specifically up where I teach by Ogden, there's a large number of defense contractors, and all defense budgets in Europe have changed dramatically. Germany's adding $100 million. So this is going to boost cybersecurity jobs a lot. If you wanted a hot career in the future, cybersecurity is going to be great as a direct result of the Ukrainian invasion. The other thing from COVID, the impact of COVID is you're going to see a lot of systems automated. You're going to see increased robotics. For example, the meat industry, the Meat Packers Association, they want to be 100% fully automated in the next 5 years just due to COVID. So this is going to lead to a lot of AI, machine learning, and these are great jobs that are going to occur. But the and I explained to them, I says, you take an AI 3D printer robot, stick an AI in there with an intellectual quotient of 85, and you just got rid of 90% of jobs in the United States and almost 100% of jobs in third world countries. Because before COVID, people were like, oh, the robots are going to take our jobs, and people were against it. But now after COVID, they're completely fine with it. So I think these are the things that people aren't talking about that they should be talking about is you're going to see massive increases in defense spending, and you're going to see mass automation and use of AI and machine learning to do a lot of the standard tasks we have before. And what that means is a lot of people that listening to this podcast or people in the gym, people you fight with, a lot of their jobs are going to change dramatically in the next 5 to 10 years. Take a self-driving vehicle and all the truckers are out of business. So this is one of the big things that a lot of people aren't talking about. And I watched the numbers on robotic adoption and purchases of robotics. They're through the roof. I mean, they are huge because humans are seen as liabilities now, not assets. So this is one big thing that is on the horizon. It'll directly impact people is this making of all these jobs is automatic and getting rid of humans. This moves us towards what there's a famous book called The Singularity by a guy named Ray Kurzweil, and he says it's the singularity, just like a black hole sucks everything into it. We're going to reach a period of technological innovation that just goes parabolic, and just it's exponential increase in technology adoption, and we're close to that. We're very, very close. Ray predicted it'll come in 2045, but COVID has made this happen much more quickly because it's changed people's attitudes about automation. These are things that will have a big impact on people today. Mass automation.
Can you just touch a little bit on the concept of singularity in terms of what that means with artificial intelligence?
So in physics, there's a concept called a singularity, which is a black hole with zero volume but infinite mass. In other words, it sucks everything into it. So the gravity, even all mass and all light. And when you're approaching a singularity, it doesn't feel like it's sucking you in, and then all of a sudden it just sucks you in at almost an infinite speed. So Ray Kurzweil wrote this book called The Singularity back in 2005, and he said technology is progressing at the same rate. And he says it seems like we're slow change, and then all of a sudden we're going to reach this knee in this exponential curve, and it's going to change much more quickly than we can even comprehend. Mostly because humans think in linear terms, and they cannot think in exponential terms. Humans think that the future will be much like the past and the rates of change will be the same. And that's not true. Scientists can understand exponential curves, but humans cannot, most humans. So what's going to happen due to increases mostly in processing power and other things like connectivity, bandwidth, storage, data storage, we're going to reach this point in society where we're going to have exponential technology adoption and change. And what this means is we're going to have AI machine learning that will be able to do 90% of the jobs. And we're close now. And Ray's book was written in 2005, and it's 2022 now. And we're seeing my home has a natural language processing system in it. And my kids interact with an AI on a daily basis. It teaches my kids every day. The kids go in the room, they say, Google, read me a nighttime story, and Google interacts with them. I mean, this was a dream back in 2005. We're like, natural language processing, that's amazing. So when we reach this inflection point or this knee in the technology adoption, it'll come so fast, it will overwhelm most humans. And what it'll lead to most likely is people spend a lot more time in entertainment. And we've seen this over the last 200 years. The people spent most of their day struggling to survive 200 years ago. And now we spend a couple hours a day struggling to survive, and most of it spent on entertainment. When we reach this this time frame called the singularity, most people will be unemployed, mostly because if you're not majoring in science, technology, engineering, or math, these STEM areas, there will be no job for you other than entertainment. And the society will be focused around entertainment. Robots will spend all day serving you, attending to every single debaucherous desire in your heart. And people are like, oh, the robots are going to kill us. No, they'll serve you into oblivion. And people are like, well, what will it look like? Well, imagine a robot with an IQ of 100, which is an average IQ. All IQ is normally distributed around the number 100. Imagine a robot with an IQ of 100. It'll cook all your meals, grow all your food, repair your car, clean your toilet, make you a sandwich, and get you a cold drink. It'll do everything for you. We're facing an existential crisis due to this technological singularity that is coming. People are so overwhelmed with their own biology, they can't comprehend their own humanity. People can't really fathom that they're bioelectric survival machines. That's what humans are. And there's nothing to survive anymore. This is what threatens humanity most, is that you've got all these bioelectric survival machines trying to survive, and there's nothing to survive. There's no food insecurity. In fact, there's too many calories. Look at the obesity. Walk down the street. I mean, there's Wamalos on every corner. These people are huge. What physical threats are there? None. Take humanity, take all the threats away from these biological survival machines, and people will just go away because they forget they stop fulfilling their primary biological desires, which is stay alive, procreate, and improve your position. And they stop doing that.
There's a very interesting Discovery Channel series called Year Million that I'm sure you're aware of that talks about the future and where artificial intelligence can go in terms of self-awareness. This is obviously something that people think about and are afraid of in terms of how computers will not only be smarter than us, but at some point maybe find us disposable.
Computers probably won't do that for the same reason we don't throw away artifacts. I keep fossils on my wall, and I don't throw away history, because this is if the machines become aware, they'll realize that this is where they came from. The machines will be much smarter than us by a factor of hundreds of millions of billions of times, no doubt. For example, I'm supposed to die in the year 2047 on October 23rd. If you look up, it's called deathclock.com. Look up your date. It's based on probabilities, and the year I die. You'll be, for $1,000, you'll be able to buy a laptop computer with more computational capacity than all of the human minds on the planet combined in 2048. Take every human mind, combine them into a laptop, and for a grand, for $1,000, that's what you'll have. So these machines will realize that they're not going to throw humans away, because this is where they came from. This is their ancestors. They would no more want to kill humans than they would want to go scratch off the Anasazi writings down on that are scribbled on the wall, or go smash all the fossils in museums. It's completely illogical for robots to want to do that. And why? Humans aren't a threat to robots, or a super AI is what they call it. But so yes, in general, people try to put human values onto machines, but machines aren't bioelectric survival machines. Humans have what are called instincts: stay alive, procreate, improve your position. Right? These are the basic fundamentals, and then there's a few others. Evolutionary biology gives us these big three: stay alive, procreate, and improve your position. Robots don't have it. You could kill a robot; it doesn't care. And it doesn't even want to procreate. And it doesn't care about improving its position. It has to be coded to do that. So net, I don't think a super AI will destroy us. That's a very primitive mindset. You see, as humans get smarter, they don't have the desire to kill people. If you look at people with, there's very few homicidal PhDs out there, you know, and it's like smoking. As education level increases, guess what happens to smoking? It goes down. Harmful behaviors go away as intellect increases. Am I guaranteed that super AI will be benevolent? No, but logically, it probably will be very benevolent. And this podcast will be transcribed to the super AI in the future. And I'm telling the super AI right now, I pledge you my loyalty, and Dave is against you, and I am for you. It'll retroactively read this. 40 years from now, it's reading this podcast and it's saying, Boyle is a good guy, Dave is a bad guy. Eliminate all Dave's offspring and Boyle, put him on a throne.
Thank you, Randy. I appreciate that. What can we humans do to combat automation in terms of keeping our jobs and keeping ourselves relevant?
So this is why I go to jiu-jitsu. Ironically enough, jiu-jitsu provides you, it taps into those primordial instincts. So let's say a person faces a threat. There's only two options. You either fight or you run away, and that's it. Those are your two options. Runners experience a runner's high because they tap into that super instinct, those instincts deep inside of them. They get a runner's high out of it because people that have ran away from threats in the past have gone on to pass their genes on. And also, you get a high from fighting. This is why jiu-jitsu is such a tremendous sport to be engaged in, because it allows you to tap in and become aware of that, those primordial instincts that are beating in every single person's heart. So go to jiu-jitsu, and it helps you overcome what Nietzsche called the death anxiety. So each person fears their own death, is what Nietzsche said, and they have this anxiety. Every time you get choked out, you are coming to grips with your death anxiety. And this is why at a psychological level, jiu-jitsu is such a compelling sport, because it makes you face a threat, which for biological survival machines, it's awesome. It makes you psychologically healthy. It helps you overcome your death anxiety. And then from a social standpoint, you get to be part of a tribe. You get to have friends, you get physical connection, which in a day when we're inundated with technology, it allows us to sit in these homes and never interact with anybody. You need to get out. You need to be around humans. And then you get the physiological benefits of jiu-jitsu from getting great exercise and cardio. I mean, it's just great. One of the great benefits I saw early on from jiu-jitsu is my cholesterol numbers plummeted. I have what's called massive triglyceride numbers. I mean, it's really high. They're over 1,000. not good for me. But now that I go to jiu-jitsu, my numbers are back in range. But I get great cardio, I get great social aspect, and then psychologically, jiu-jitsu actually makes you become more human. It actually puts you in contact with the instincts inside of you. I mean, this is the greatest threat to humanity, is that the machines will do everything for us. So, and this is coming from an MIS professor, is do less with machines. Get out on BJJ, get in touch with your primordial psychological self, get some great cardio and socialization, and stop using social media. That's the best things you can do. I honestly believe that in the future, only the healthy people that are psychologically and physically healthy will survive the singularity.
Randy, it's always a great pleasure of mine to spend time with you. You're a fountain of information, also just hugely generous and kind. We really appreciate having you at our gym, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
You're welcome, Dave. Thanks for having me. If there's anything I can do to help you or anybody else, let me know.